Welcome to Character Explorations, a podcast production of the Wendt Center for Character Education at the University of Dubuque. I'm Annalee Ward, and our guest today is Dr. Dale Easley, Professor of Geology. He is the author of the article, The Inevitability of Dying. This sounds like it could be really bleak, but while it is a serious topic, Dr. Easley, you help us think about it with your stories. And we hope to our listeners that this interview gives you a taste of what Dr. Easley wrote and sends you to read the essay available online at dbq.edu/went. That's www.dbq.edu/WENDT. Welcome, Dale.
Thank you for inviting me.
We're happy to have you here and to learn more about this article. You wrote it for the journal issue, Character and Inevitability, not exactly in the realm of geology, your academic teaching, but those of us who know you know of your passion for storytelling. Can you tell us just a little bit about you and perhaps an experience you have that might illustrate how you began to write about this topic?
I've been thinking about the inevitability of death since I was a student at 19 at college myself. My sophomore year of college, my father was diagnosed with leukemia, and then the spring semester he died. And so that was, for me, the turning point to adulthood. It was a change in my worldview that took place. Before that, most things had worked out pretty much like I wanted them. I guess you could say I had a privileged, easy life in a lot of ways. And suddenly all that seemed turned over. So that was the big event in my life related to death.
I know that we're going to be delving into that a little bit more, but you also share another incident.
Later on, after I finished graduate school, I worked at the University of New Orleans for about 15 years before I moved to Dubuque. And while I was in New Orleans, I got back into what had got me into geology, which was not rocks, no love of rocks. It was water resources and sustainability. And so I took student groups down to Haiti. We were studying sustainability. I'd gone a few times before to work on water wells. And on one of those trips, a student named Jennifer came along. And about 3 weeks after we returned from the trip, Jennifer had some paralysis, called the ambulance, went to the hospital. And by the time she got there, she was feeling somewhat better. Jennifer didn't have insurance. They set her on a bench and left her there for over 5 hours. And Jennifer got up to go to the bathroom, passed out, went into a coma, and died. She was 25 at the time. The coroner told a nurse who told her mother that Jennifer died from meningitis that she'd caught from a mosquito bite she'd received in Haiti. It seemed like at that time that going to Haiti with me was the reason for her dying. As it turned out, she actually had a brain aneurysm. The CDC got involved with the case because meningitis was a concern in the southeast United States, and there were parts of her brain were sent to the CDC to analyze, and it turned out she'd had a brain aneurysm. One of my friends had a brain aneurysm about the same time, and his wife was a nurse. He was treated very quickly and recovered, played volleyball again within a month. If Jennifer had been treated immediately, there's a good chance she would have survived.
So you've been carrying these kinds of stories with you, and they're painful.
Yeah.
As you began to write this article, we all read together Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. And as you turned to that to engage with this topic, what did you find in there to help you go forward?
I first read Man's Search for Meaning when I was a freshman in college. It was one of our textbooks. It's considered one of the top 10 books of the 20th century. Very influential. And one of the things that stood out back then and still comes back to me is the idea that when things get to their very worst, we still have the freedom to choose our attitude towards our suffering. And so when we're thinking about the way in which we deal with the death of our loved ones, we still get some choice about how that is looked at, what kind of meaning we create or find from it.
So getting that choice and using that as your framework for thinking about inevitability and death, you also employ storytelling. And tell us a little bit about why or how storytelling is important or powerful for you.
As you mentioned earlier, I'm a geologist by training, teach environmental science classes and statistics and things like that. And at this point, I don't think one more graph of carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere is going to influence anybody's attitude towards global climate change. I think the individual stories that we tell are the way in which we can begin to break through and form relationships. So in my introductory geology class, way too many of my students have had to listen to me tell about Hurricane Katrina. Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans about 8 months after I moved up here. I was incredibly fortunate to be here instead of down there. I'd sold my house and it then had 6.5 feet of water in that. And I show that class a video that was done by Spike Lee, or a clip from that video, When the Levees Broke. An interview with Paris Irvin. Paris Irvin was one of my students. He'd been to my house. He'd been on field trips with me. Knew Paris quite well. And Spike Lee interviews him because Paris returned after Hurricane Katrina and his mother had drowned and her body was under the fridge. Yeah. So those students see that, and instead of another natural disaster that seems to come down all the time, they're seeing an event, the death of the mother, that they can all relate to. And suddenly, I think, when I talk about the effect of oceans warming on the strength of hurricanes and stuff like that, it makes it more real for them. And so storytelling, humans are narrative creatures. We produce and organize the meaning in our lives by telling stories. But going back to Frankl, we get a choice about those stories that we tell.
And from there, you give us some examples of choices that you have to face in navigating your own histories and stories. Could you just share perhaps one, maybe the story of your father, how you have used narrative to work forward in hope?
Sure. I'll start with the two versions of the story about my father's death. I'm going to read what I have in the paper for that because they're very short. First story. My story as an adult begins when I was 19 and a sophomore in college. Just after I was home for Thanksgiving, my father was diagnosed with leukemia. He spent the next 6.5 weeks in the hospital before dying in an intensive care unit. Our family had agreed that we didn't want to die hooked up to machines in a hospital, but that's exactly what happened with my father. It wasn't the death we envisioned or what he desired.
And that's one story that, I mean, we've condensed it, obviously, but it's one memory you hold and one way to think about that. But you've also shown us another way to think about that.
Yes. That first story is a story of failure and regret. The focus is on the downward trajectory of the illness, the poor decisions made, and the sense of disempowerment. Effect is to add a burden to surviving loved ones. Mm-hmm. The question is, what should I have done? A different story is this one. Again, I read from what I wrote. During Christmas, Dad was going through the chemotherapy for the second unsuccessful time. Despite his troubles, he thought of Mom's wish for a wooden trunk in which to store some of her work, quilts, baskets, needlepoint, sewing. With the help of a friend, he arranged to refurbish an old wooden trunk. My future brother-in-law and I snuck it into the house on Christmas Eve while Mom was in the bath. The next morning, after we'd finished unwrapping all the presents, we gave Mom that trunk. This is a story of love.
Absolutely. And the story is something that you want to remember about your father, about how he lived, even as he was dying. He lived out of love. Narrative helps us organize our meaning of our lives and of our loved ones. And as we face these painful losses, the inevitability of them, you've thought a lot about how to navigate through storytelling, and you've also talked about logotherapy from Frankl or cognitive behavioral therapy as potential tools for helping to change the narratives of negativity and limitation. Do you have any other suggestions for how we change the stories? And I just have to point out, you're not talking here about lying. You're talking about substitution in a way, right?
Correct. In statistics, we talk about choosing our variables. What are the things that we focus on? And what are the important things that we leave out? What are the biases that come in? And stories are the same way. We choose which things we're going to emphasize, which things we're going to leave out. As Frankl would say, we choose our attitude towards our suffering. And so by choosing which parts of the story empower us, we have the hope at least to find some meaning in that suffering and using it to make better decisions the next time. If you will allow, then I'll talk through that with my mom. My mom's death was many years later, when I was in my 50s, and she had developed dementia. So if it's okay with you, I'll read the two stories there.
Okay.
When my mother began to develop dementia, I convinced her to move to a memory care facility that had locking doors to prevent her from leaving. In her perception, I went from being her golden boy to being her jailer. Though I was trying to keep her safe while also taking care of the logistics, I soon had to try to appease her anger at being in an institution. Family members were of little help. Ultimately, she, like Dad, died in an institution hooked up to an IV. Like in that first story of my dad, this is a story of distress and failure. We had good intentions, but the outcome was not. There's isolation, disappointment, medicalization. An alternative version of the story is the following. As Mom's dementia progressed, she was endangering herself and others by driving. Later at the memory care unit, she wandered the halls at night, going into others' rooms. If it weren't for the locked door, I don't doubt that she would have wandered out and down the road. I was still being a good son by trying to keep her safe. When she died, I, my sister, and my niece were with her. We'd work with the hospice to ensure that Mom felt little pain, thus the morphine drip. Though Mom didn't die at home, she died in the bed where she'd slept for months, surrounded by family.
And surrounded by those who love her and cared for her with all that they could. And that is a beautiful story. It is not made up. It is not a lie. It is truth. And so you've got these two versions. You carry them both, but you remember the hope and the power of the good intentions. I think that what you have done in this paper is given us all tools to navigate inevitabilities in our lives and to do it in ways that give us the power to move forward. You've also talked about how death is inevitable, but you suggested that moral character is involved. Would you say just a little bit more about that?
In the example of my father, I think it was certainly clear. He's in the hospital bed, going through chemotherapy, losing his hair, losing control of himself. And yet, he's thinking about Mom and wanting her to have a good Christmas. When we think about good moral character, the Golden Rule is a clear guideline. He was thinking about others and loving them instead of focusing on his own suffering.
And even as you tell these stories, your character is important. That you be reminded that you are acting out of love.
That's a very good point. When I look at those good things that Dad did, for example, it calls me to not focus on my own trivial suffering, but to focus on how I can help other people and make their lives happier and better.
What a wonderful, wonderful thing to take forward. We all will deal with death. It is inevitable. It's the ultimate inevitability here. But doing so with character and with the choosing of our attitudes and the choosing of the focus of our stories is a way to help all of us. And so I thank you for what you've written in this. In tackling the topic most people would rather avoid. So as we wrap this up, I just wanted to give you the opportunity. Are there any last comments you wanted to share?
I think journaling is something that's really helpful, useful for everyone. Giving yourself a chance to write down every day just what's in your mind, stream of consciousness. Begin to get to know the workings of your own mind and emotions a little bit better. Because again, you don't have a choice until you recognize that there are other ways of doing things. And so journaling and keeping those journals, looking back and seeing where you've been and what your attitude was in the past is a really good way to get to know yourself better. The other thing is humans are community oriented, and I find the best times in my life are sitting over a cup of coffee or a beer with friends and having a good conversation. Having someone who sees you and knows you is just a great gift. And you can also be that person for someone else.
Thank you. Thank you for those reminders. The power of community, the power of taking time to write and reflect, those are just important gifts for all of us. Our guest today has been Dr. Dale Easley, Professor of Geology, and I'm Annalee Ward for Character Explorations from the Wendt Center for Character Education at the University of Dubuque.